on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5 Live.
Anyway, let's see what we
do with, bash
with the box office top 10 and see how far we get.
You've got my piece of paper, so that's okay. Oh, no, I've got another one here.
Marley and Me is hanging on in there at number 10, everyone's favourite.
Somebody I know locally came up to me in the village the other day and said, I can't have a dog. And I thought, OK, fine, fair enough. Because I'd said, you know, why do people watch Marley and Me? Why don't you just get a dog? And, of course, it's not possible for everyone to have a dog. There are certain circumstances under which you can't have a dog. But even if you can't have a dog, there's really no reason to go and see Marley and Me.
A number of people have done, you know, Marley and M, if they just drop the E, because then it has a kind of a James Bond connotation.
Yeah, or a sort of German expressionist serial killer sort of connotation.
Knowing's at 9.
Yes. Now, what do you do when the numbers run out? And this has
count
been
back from a higher number.
You were off when this came out, right?
Yes.
And Colin said that he thought it was the worst movie he'd ever seen.
Yes, I believe.
It isn't. I mean, it isn't. I mean, it's not. It's all over the place, but it isn't the worst movie. And in fact, if M. Night Shyamalan made it, he would have felt that he'd stepped up recently and gone back to his original form. I mean, it is apocalyptic tosh of the highest order, but it's quite sort of 70s apocalyptic tosh of the highest order. And Nick Horseface Equine Cage does his mooing around in that way that he usually does. I know a horse doesn't moo. I know that's a cow.
Just going to point
that out. But I just leapt in before you did. It's not terrible. It's not any good, but it's not terrible.
What do you do when the numbers run out? I just wonder if Alistair Darling's going to be looking at that post and thinking, you know what, of all the films I'm going to go and see, it's not going to be that one.
On the subject of which...
Oh, yes, In the Loop. There it is at number 8.
And I was so cross that I was off when this came out. Just let me do this. So that's me cracking my fingers. Because
why do you do that?
Because regarding In the Loop, as you know, because In the Loop is the sort of spin-off of The Thick of It, and there's a central character in it who is, in inverted commas, slightly inspired by Alistair Campbell. And as you know, I went to see the film with Alistair Campbell, and I had to interview him for the Culture Show afterwards, and he was, you know, perfectly civil, and even though we sort of see things from a different way. But the one point he got rattled in the interview was that the film portrays all politics as essentially venal and crass, and I said, I do think that the politics is essentially venal and crass, and I think, you know, that's kind of your legacy. And he got cross, well, not cross, he got agitated and said, it bothers me that somebody apparently intelligent, you know, clearly not, could think that politics is all venal and crass, because obviously that's just a nonsensical thing to think. And then, in the week that In the Loop comes out, politics demonstrates itself to be more venal and crass than any of us had ever previously imagined. Even the diehard old saber-rattling trots amongst us were astonished by the level of crass venality that broke in the email stuff the week that In the Loop came out. And I just want to see Alistair Darling once more to be able to say, excuse me, Q, and if you will, ED.
Yeah, Alistair, the difference between Alistair Campbell.
Did I say Alistair Darling both
Top
times?
Top 5 Live political analysis there from Dr. Mark Kerman. Oh, we've been missing you so much.
It's because you confused me by saying, what's his name, Darling? Alistair Campbell. Did I say Alistair Darling all the way through that?
No.
That really, no, funny.
You flipped from one Alistair.
It would have worked much better if I'd said Alistair.
One loved Alistair too.
I want to see Alistair Campbell again and say QED.
Dear Miss Slocum and Miss Brahms, In the Loop is the funniest film I've seen in years. The writing was faultless, although at times very near the knuckle. You cracked them if you...
I did, yeah.
I'll have to do it.
Can you do it?
No, stop.
However, you can do it as well.
It suffered in translation from TV to film. Mark often describes films as uncinematic. I felt In the Loop would probably be better suited for television.
It is true that it stretches itself in becoming a film, but there is enough in the sort of the first 45 minutes to justify the bagginess of the of what comes afterwards. And it's on surer terms when it's back in England rather than when it's back in Britain rather than when it goes off to America. I've got to stop doing that because I get so much flack for it.
Jerry in Bristol. Hi, guys. If I can miss the letter off both words.
Yeah.
Robert De Niro stars as a man on the edge, entering a crisis, despised by society, is the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Tax Drive.
Very good.
He's just taking it.
Yep.
Two extremes now. In the box office top 10, tell us about the movies that we are going to be doing a bit later on once we've finished the
State
top
of Play. Of course, you had Kevin MacDonald in on the show.
Yes. This time last week.
We are also going to do Observe and Report, which was the Seth Rogen movie, which, as you already know, I wasn't a huge fan of. Shifty, Outlanders, Uninvited, Encounters at the End of the World, the new Werner Herzog movie. Werner Herzog goes to meet people at the end of the world and discovers that he doesn't want to talk to the fluffy penguins.
I've missed the impressions.
Yeah.
They're back. Very much. So we've done Marley and Me, Knowing, In the Loop at 8, Race to Witch Mountain at 7.
Yeah, it's a funny old thing. I like Race to Witch Mountain. Do you remember Escape to Witch Mountain and then Return?
Well, only vaguely, not really.
No? You didn't see them when you were...
Can't remember. I don't think so. It didn't make much of an impact. Well, the poster looks familiar.
No, they were sort of successful Disney movies. And I remember quite liking Escape to Witch Mountain the first time around, because it was slightly creepy in a slightly sort of Village of the Damned way, these two kids who had these weird powers because actually they are from outer space. And when we were talking about it before, I said, well, don't give it away. But of course, actually, the poster is a huge spaceship landing on a big thing, and it's pretty clever. But I thought it was good fun. I thought it was, you know, it was solidly done. It's not groundbreaking in any respect, but it's a good, entertaining film with you know, good young male and female leads, and well handled all round.
This from Francis Ryan, BSc, bracket ons, PGCE, MRSC. This is because The Boat That Rocked is at number 6. Dear Dr. Yeah. Watson and Dr. Crick, enjoying a rare night at the cinema with a friend. A couple of weeks ago, we decided to take the real doctor's advice and went to see The Boat That Rocked. We went to the 9 o'clock showing, both being mothers of young children, fully expected to be asleep by, let's say 9.45, as occurred the last time we went to the cinema together and saw The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. However,
they just saw The Lion, but neither The Witch nor The Wardrobe.
Not only were we both still awake at the end of the film, we spent the previous two or so hours highly entertained by both the film and the leather-clad rocker in the row in front, who had sung and danced while sitting down his way through the film. We left the cinema with a warm, fuzzy glow and smiles on our faces, but when my husband asked me what it was about, I couldn't really remember. I'd only managed there was a boat, they played groovy tunes, and it sank. He was therefore a little confused as to why I was so cheerful. Love Jason Isaacs on the show the other way. Say hello to him from me.
That was no leather-clad rocker. That was me enjoying myself in the I mean, I think I laughed more than you did.
You definitely did laugh more.
I mean, I did laugh, and I enjoyed it. I know all the things that are wrong with it, and I've read lots of highbrow papers, not just the paper that you always say I read, giving it a right old kicking. And frankly, I don't care, because I did enjoy it, and I suspect that I might enjoy it again a second time round on DVD on a long haul flight. But I have had texts from friends of mine using language which is not entirely repeatable.
Good.
On
well,
the subject of
what, no, I had to apologise for one.
No, I mean, well, when have I ever done that, Simon?
No, absolutely.
But right. But no, it was
that's because you are, let's say, out of kilter with majority critic opinion.
Yes, I am. I'm right, and the rest of them have got to play catch-up. I mean, it is all over the place in terms of its structural thing. It's much too long, and it has five endings, and none of them really work. And it is true that the boat sinks, but that's not the end of the film. Because one of the things that Richard Curtis does is that, you know, he writes a sort of, you know, a lengthy screenplay, and then he pretty much seems to film all of it, and then sort of puts all of it together, and then says, there you go. So, you know, you can take out the bits you like, but, I mean, what he really needs is Roger Corman going in there with a big chainsaw and saying it's got to be 95 minutes long. That, I think, would be the only thing that would improve it. But I laughed all the way through.
Plus, maybe a little whisper, which is, when father and son get reunited, you don't have
to play father and son. And when the woman comes on the boat who's got the name of the song. Which one is it? She's called...
Eleanor.
Eleanor, that's right, yeah.
Oh, I wonder what's going to be coming up next.
Yes.
Now we have Crank 2 High Voltage number 5. Dear Fanboy and Ladyboy, says Lars Silverton.
That makes you Ladyboy, incidentally.
Halfway through a BA in Media Studies, a very fine endeavour indeed, says Lars. I had the misfortune of sitting through Crank 2 the other day, but with dialogue entirely in Russian. Don't speak a word of the language personally.
Really? What does it sound like?
I
suspect DOS for Dania.
It wouldn't have made any difference if I did.
Awful stuff.
Awful stuff, though strangely influential, as I spent much of the film's running time wanting to electrocute myself, which seems a little bit drastic.
So I went to see, because I've been off, as you know, and I went to see Crank 2 because I knew it would be in the top 10 and I needed to catch up with it. And I have a sort of strange relationship with Jason Statham. I mean, not in the real world, I don't have any relationship with Jason Statham, but in the imaginary relationship in my head. Jason Statham. His movies break down into two groups. There's the movies like Transporter, and the Transporter 3, which has just come out on DVD this week, which is the one in which Jason basically does the male striptease thing, because the Russian girlfriend says to him, oh, why don't you... She, you know, that's the Russian thing. She says, oh, yes, it was sexy when you took your shirt off and killed the man with it. Now do it again for me. And he does it again. And it's all incredibly sort of homoerotic, but it's pretending that isn't what it is. And then there's the movies like Crank, which are completely like going out there. My good friend Alan Jones, who used to write for writes for Fangoria magazine, and is one of the sort of the horror critics that I would think is the most tolerant of completely unacceptable behavior on screen. And even he said that Crank 2 was needlessly offensive. And it is true that it is needlessly offensive. It's the series of movies in which Jason Statham, in the first one, the tagline is he died but then he got better. In the first one, if you remember, he has to keep his adrenaline level up, otherwise he'll stop. So he has to keep doing things that will keep his adrenaline growing, otherwise he'll die, right? Mm-hmm. Then he dies at the end of it. Now, in this one, he wakes up, he gets a heart transplant, he gets given a heart that keeps having to be electrocuted, and then he does, you know, terrible stuff. Now, Andrew Collins was on the show and talked about the moment that he walked out of Crank 2. And I don't see any reason to repeat that moment.
After about 25 minutes.
But he said very specifically there was a thing that happened, a scene in the strip club that he thought was...
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't, just because it is a grotesque scene, it's completely, out... It's just unacceptable on almost every level. Interesting enough, if you look at the census report, I can't even read out... I mean, it says it's an 18 certificate. It says because it contains frequent strong language, gore, sex, and very strong violence. And then it sort of explains the very strong violence that I can't read out in the thing. Needless to say, you remember the movie with Danny Dyer and Gillian Anderson?
Well, oh, yes.
Yeah, well, that features. And that's one of the sort of the lighter moments.
See previous podcasts for details.
Exactly. But the funny thing about it is, I mean, it is absolute garbage. It has clearly been made by people sitting down and going, let's make absolute garbage. Not just like slight garbage. Let's go back to kind of the days of The Incredible Torture Show and Bloodsucking Freaks. You know, let's make something that is absolute garbage. And what can we do in order to make sure that every single box of garbage has been ticked? But they've done so in a way which is almost, but not quite, so extreme that it kind of goes into surrealism. And what Andrew missed by walking out was a cameo appearance by Jerry Halliwell at a moment when Chev Chelios electrocutes him. He has to keep electrocuting himself. He electrocutes himself, and then he suddenly goes into a flashback of himself. Well, it's not a flashback. It's an imaginary suit because of him on a game show in which Jerry Halliwell is his mum. Then there's another sequence in which he gets electrocuted so much he turns into a Godzilla-style monster with a big monster Jason Statham head on to have a fight with another bloke with a big monster head on. But it's like, remember that thing they used to do on TFI Friday with the guys walking around with the U2 heads on? Do you remember that? With
No.
No, you must remember that. Everybody remembers that.
Oh, okay,
that.
Yes, I do.
The four dancing guys with the big Bonio head and the big hedge head. It's like that. And
oh,
then,
right, great.
So it's absolute garbage, but with really strange, odd, surreal moments thrown in that you almost think are satirical, and yet it's not possible for it to be satirical. I mean, I have to say, at no point was I bored. I was genuinely quite eye-peelingly worried. And you just sit there thinking, I'm surprised this film actually exists.
I Love You, Man at number 4.
Didn't see it. But Andrew liked it.
17 again at 3.
Did see it. The verdict is, well, there's three different verdicts, because I took my kids to see it. So,
but it's a 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So parental guidance. Yeah, parental guidance is allowed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's what it says. If you want to bring people in under that age, you have to take account of
what... We looked it up and said kind of like smutty jokes all the way through.
Yeah, it was. That's all it is. It's a Zac Efron movie, and every now and then there's a sort of... There's innuendo in it, but it's very mild. I mean, I'd say it's borderline PG-12, but I did check it out on the BBFC website. I would advise everybody else to do so. And the general feeling was that it's not one of Zac Efron's best, although I do like Zac Efron.
What would be Zac Efron's best, then?
High School Musical 3.
Of course. Fast and Furious at 2.
Again, been away. And it was a choice between catching that and catching Crank 2, and I don't believe that whatever else is in Fast and Furious 2, it would have a scene of Jason Statham as Godzilla with a monster head fighting a bloke with his foot in a battery.
UK's number one, it being Holes and All, Monsters versus Aliens.
And it's a funny thing, because I've started to worry about this 3D specs thing. The more I think about the cost of the 3D specs thing, and the more I think, the movies were made in 3D, they're made to be seen in 3D. If you're going to see a movie, you might as well see it in 3D, but I'm very, very irate about the idea of having to pay more to see 3D, particularly since, as we all know, 3D is really being rammed down our throats in order to prevent piracy. The movie industry is saying, oh, how can we do something that's not piratable? Well, let's do 3D, because you have to see that in the cinema, and therefore it's really an insurance policy for them, so why should we have to fund it? So I've gone from being slightly dubious about 3D, sort of benignly dubious, to being a little bit more cross about it. I'd be a lot less cross about it if it cost exactly the same as all the other movies.
Or if you went once, you could keep the glasses and then go back and get charged the amount. It doesn't work like that.
We've been around this. You're not being charged for the glasses. You're being charged for the fact that it cost them money to put in the screen. Which, I know, it's like saying, oh, you want a cup with that coffee? I was just going to pour it on the floor.
But the film,
that's an extra 50p.
But the film itself is quite fun, even though Seth Rogen's got
it. It is quite fun, and if you're going to see it, you should see it in 3D, because it's like, if you're going to see it, it's like, do you remember when Earthquake came out back in the 1970s?
No.
Yes, you do.
Oh, yes, I forget. Of course I remember it.
Hang on. Do you remember when Earthquake came out?
Well, I wasn't old enough, but yes, I'm familiar with Earthquake.
Just say yes.
Sensoround.
Sensoround. There we go.
There
fine.
You go. Everyone knows about that, Simon.
Yes, there's no point.
There's a difference between knowing about it and remembering it when it came out.
It's an important thing because the
you
thing...
You didn't say, do you know about it? Because the answer would have been, yes, I do. But do I remember it when it came out? Answer, no, I don't.
You know, it's funny. There's a line in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right? When Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent have been apart for absolutely, you know, eons of time, and Douglas Adams uses that phrase that Ford Prefect was one of those people you couldn't see for ages but would be almost immediately annoying.
What's that got to do with Nick Dunkard? That is so unfair.
Right, Sensoround. If you want to see Earthquake, you had to see it in Sensoround. If you're going to see Monster vs. Aliens, you kind of have to see it in 3D. But they didn't, as far as I remember, they didn't charge you extra for the Sensoround. And you do remember it. You're just pretending not to, to make you seem younger than
oh,
you are.
Oh, yes, you're so right.
You said, I mean, that's what Nick said. It was, I was too young to remember Sensoround.
Jeremy _ Morley and Mitch Benn also sent this just on the lose the last letter game. The Long Good Frida. The harrowing story of an especially tall but especially worthy Norwegian woman.
As you pointed out, Swedish, surely.
Well, Swedish, if that's going to be an ABBA joke.
Frida Kahlo could have been of an incredibly tall artist.
But The Long Good Frida, actually, is not a bad idea.
No, that's very good.
Dear Hurrah and Harumph, says Evil One. What about The Spy Who Loved M? Slightly different take. That would be entirely different. And Mitch is back with a couple here. No Country for Old Me. An elderly gentleman retires to the Costa del Sol, and there will be blue, BLWO, one man's quest to invent a self-flushing toilet freshener.
This is very good.
Okay, well, if you can do better, let us know. Big movie of the week would appear to be State of Play. Lots of good references on the film poster, which make you think, that looks interesting. Now, got an interesting cast.
You've seen the film, haven't
have
you?
Indeed
seen okay, cause
so.
You had, because Kevin MacDonald did come in.
He did indeed.
Okay, fine. So, for those...
He was slightly spaced out, but he was very interesting.
Okay, fine. Just obvious background, is the adaptation of a TV series that was written by Paul Abbott, who wrote Shameless, which actually I did get a handle on Shameless. I remember watching the Shameless Christmas special because I think I had to review it for Newsnight Review and thinking this is actually very, very good. I know everybody else is far much more up on TV than I am, but believe me, I'm playing catch up and it's taking a long time. I got given the box set of The Wire. Colin gave me the Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's just an awful lot of viewing. I mean, watching a movie is like 2 hours, but watching a box set of a TV series, you know, meanwhile, ER apparently is just finishing. And apparently there's something like a billion hours of that if you wanted to catch up with that. I can't be bothered, really. But anyway, so per Paul Abbott TV series, the original, which I did see because The Observer asked me to watch it as part of this article I had to write about whether or not it was any longer true that television was inferior to the cinema. This was because last year we'd had such bad movies in the cinema and they'd been quite got a lot of good television on. It was John Sim and David Morrissey as a journo and a politico who were separately involved in a scandal which kicks off when a young woman dies. And apparently the movie adaptation, I'm sure you covered this already with Kevin MacDonald, was originally meant to star Brad Pitt and Ed Norton. And then Brad Pitt dropped out because they needed rewrites doing, but there was a writer's strike, and then Ed Norton couldn't, they then rescheduled it, and Ed Norton couldn't do it because he was down to do something else. And then other names that were attached to it were meant to have included Johnny Depp at some point, Nick Cage at some point, Tom Hanks at some point, although Tom Hanks was presumably still sporting the bad haircut from Angels and Demons or The Da Vinci Code.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, is it a sequel?
Next
is
week,
it a prequel?
Not sure. Not that.
Do you think they will have turned the lights on
Probably
this
not.
Time round? Because the last time round it worked very, very badly. So now we have it with Russell Crowe and Ben Affleck. Russell Crowe as the schlubby down at heel journalist, and Ben Affleck because they've moved it to America, being the senator rather than the politician. So the story is essentially as before in the TV series, although with some kind of changes in the way in which the plots intertwine. Ben Affleck's a senator. There's a very important set of hearings that are going on. A young woman dies who is connected to Ben Affleck, and Ben Affleck realizes that his reputation is on the line. Meanwhile, Russell Crowe is the journalist who's clearly based on one of the, you know, the Woodward and Bernstein thing. In fact, there's a picture on his booth. He has a sort of schlubby booth which is covered in chocolate wrappers and old cups, and there's a picture of Woodward and Bernstein, although actually looking at it, I wasn't sure whether it was a picture of Woodward and Bernstein or whether it was a picture of Redford and Hoffman, which kind of would have made sense as in the world of the movie, you know, the, all the President's Men people are more real. And I thought it was an in-joke, but it may actually have been a picture of Woodward and Bernstein. In fact, it probably turned out not to be either of them. Probably it turned out to be Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. I just didn't have my glasses on. Anyway, he realises there's a story breaking and he's connected to it because he's connected to the old politician. Major difference as well is he's now working for a newspaper for whom the editor is Helen Mirren.
I want to bring some more people in to work with you on this, Carl, on the political side, people with real experience. I'm thinking Ted Moody. I mean, Ted's perfect for this.
Are you taking me off the story?
No, not off, just off point. If this is as big as he says it is, a big if, then it's going to be good for you.
How is that good?
Well, watching seasoned reporters at work on a big story, you know, being part of it all, you'll learn a lot. So, Ted Moody, what do you think?
Don't let her do it.
And, Cal, if you're on this, I want this to be clean, through and through.
Tell
I don't
her
want the
to
congressman
forget it.
Getting...
It's your gig. You got it. Get loud now.
Excuse me, you're defending her now?
She's fine. I can work with her.
But, Cal, she's inexperienced.
Inexperience isn't fatal.
I'm not giving up the story. I just, if I could just have a few more days with it, I promise you I'm not going to let you down.
Don't throw those Dewey Cub reporter eyes at me. It's nauseating.
Now, it seems to me that the reason that they brought in Helen Mirren to be the editor of the paper is because she's able to throw around mid-range Anglo-Saxon expletives more convincingly than almost anybody else. And she does an awful lot of that, but in a very sort of Helen Mirren kind of way. And every time she does it, there's a sort of knowing titter amongst the audience because it's like she's kind of allowed to do anything. And Russell Crowe is doing that thing that Russell Crowe does, which is that the seriousness of his performance is directly related to his body weight. So the more puffed up he is, the more serious the role. The more pumped up he is, the less serious the role. So on the one hand, you have things, I suppose, start with Romper Stomper and then, you know, what was he called in Gladiator? Maximus, isn't it? You know, I am Gladiator! And then you've got things like the Jeffrey Wigand role in The Insider, in which he's schlubby and shorter but fatter, and then...
That was the tobacco industry.
That was the tobacco industry, which I still think is his finest role. I mean, I think he was absolutely brilliant in that. And it's a really odd thing with Russell Crowe. It's like, look, man, if I'm being schlubby... He's Australian, isn't he? So, look, man, the thing is, if I'm doing schlubby, mate, all right? If I'm doing schlubby, it means I'm doing serious. I have to do the pumping up stuff. You know, that's not South Africa. That's the South African
just,
rather than...
Just stick to normal.
Do you remember when he won the BAFTA award? And he got really cross because a television executive cut out from the televised version of it. He read a poem out, and they cut that out of the televised broadcast. And he got very cross. And he subsequently had to sort of apologise. Well, that's very much Russell Crowe, the dual man. It's not on the one hand there's the kind of hard man, the tough guy. On the other hand, there's the serious, introspective. Now, what we have here is Russell Crowe, schlubby, serious, fat, doing all that stuff. On the other hand, you have Ben Affleck, who I think is fairly wooden as the senator. But I was wondering whether the point of that is that he's meant to be wooden. I mean, I remember that in the TV show, I don't remember David Morrissey's character. Did you? You saw the TV show, right?
Yeah, yeah.
David Morrissey's character wasn't anything like as two-dimensional as Ben Affleck, was he?
No, I mean, but he had more to do. In, you know, given the whole the nature of state of play on television, that role was just more substantial.
It was, because in this, it is very much a cipher role. He is there to sort of look handsome and square-jawed, but then looks somehow strangely implicated. But actually, whereas the television show was very much a two-hander, this is very much Russell Crowe's movie with some other people going on around him. Now, that All the President's Men thing, there was a review of this movie today in Metro which said something which really stung me. It was by Lewishka, who's a very smart woman. There was a little thing and it said, you know all those Gene Hackman thrillers that your dad really likes? It's like that. And I suddenly realised, that's it. I've become the dad that really likes the Gene Hackman thrillers. And it sort of does allude quite knowingly to All the President's Men. But if you remember, in All the President's Men, the one action moment is that, well, it's not even an action moment, is when Robert Redford goes downstairs into a car park and he's meeting Deep Throat, and there's a suggestion that there's somebody hiding behind one of the cars, and then a car pulls out, and is it an assassin? Isn't, and then that's it. Well, nowadays, of course, you can't get away with that level of non-action. So even in something which is essentially a talky political thriller about the corridors of power, about the workings of journalism, you have to have shootouts and car chases, and it does have full-on action sequences, and Kevin McDonald handles all those very well. There is also a moment about halfway through it when Helen Mirren says, "We're going to press now. I need the copy now." And an awful lot of stuff happens between that point and the point at which Russell Crowe finally seems to be able to, incidentally, input the copy directly onto the front page. I mean, I
I'm sure that's possible. But that's just like in lots of movies. They say, we've got 10 seconds to get out of the building. You know, and about 2 minutes later, it's still
no, I know, but, down to but four. Yes, but this is, it's like there's 10 seconds to get out of the building and there is, we're going to press now, I need the copy now. Okay, I've just got to go to a room, set up an interrogation thing, get the guy, frame the other guy, get the thing, go down in the car park with the shooter, get back up, find out it wasn't him, stop. And there's many moments. I mean, at one point, clearly the front page has stopped, that everything would have gone to press, right? Then the story develops another aspect. You don't then hold the front page and rewrite the story. You do it tomorrow. You write, you know, the story we printed yesterday. Well, believe me, the truth is even weirder than that. But no, because it's a movie convention, they have to absolutely hold everything until literally there are guys standing like this waiting to receive the newspapers as they get thrown off the production, then straight into the newsstand, by which point it must be, you know, middle of next week. So all of those things are to some extent a result of the compression that you have to do with the TV show. And I looked at what I'd written in The Observer because I didn't want to, because sometimes, you know, you can remember wrongly how you wrote. I said, even in The Observer, when I saw the TV thing, I said, it's great, I love John Sim, love David Morrissey, very well written, but it is guilty of that kind of TV histrionics of it's a thriller plot that needs to be slight, you know, he's connected to her and she's connected to him, but then there's a twist and this, that and the other. It kind of overdoes it. But when you compress all that stuff into 2 hours, it does become a bit silly. It's therefore to the film's credit that despite the fact that it's a bit silly, and despite the fact that Russell Crowe is doing the serious performance, but is essentially really doing a movie performance of a journalist. I mean, you know, he's driving around in the car, eating the chocolate, filing the copy, ringing up, doing... I mean, that's a movie journalist. It's not a journalist. I mean, you've met real journalists, right?
Well, there are quite a few around.
Yeah. No, but they're not
let's
like
just,
that,
let's just
are they?
Around. Oh, look.
All right, I'm just not. I'm why do
you
there's
ask,
really no point in doing this if you're just going to be fat.
Why don't you ask just.
Do you, okay, do you know any journalists that look like Russell Crowe even when he's fat?
Paper journalists, yeah. I don't know any broadcast journalists like that, but I do know newspaper journalists like that.
Who look like Russell Crowe?
Yeah.
Who?
That's why they're in papers. I'm not telling you who they are.
No, but yeah, you leave her alone. Don't pick on her.
She just helped. Told me
I don't
to.
I don't think it's a compliment.
Oh, well, that's the difference, you see. I think that even when Russell Crowe is pretending to be, you know, to be dumpy and schlubby, he still looks like Russell Crowe. Anyway, to the movie's credit, I think the movie is gripping and thrilling and I enjoyed it and I thought it was very entertaining, but it is popcorn fodder. It is, in the end, not a serious heavyweight movie, which perhaps it has some pretensions to be. And the moment at which you realise that is the moment in which they have to do the action chase shootout thing. And the moment when halfway through Helen Mirren says, we're going to press, and you realise that not only are they not going to press, you're not going to the loo for another hour, because that's how long the movie's got to run.
Mark Gregerson, BA Honours Accountancy and Finance, Dear George and Lenny, saw a preview of State of Play. Excellent film. I'm awaiting delivery of the BBC series on DVD so I can compare. Mm. However, two moments completely took me out of the film. One, the Ben Affleck appearing in the worst Photoshop photo in the history of Hollywood productions. Look out for it on his is it on his desk.
Yeah, there's a couple of things, isn't it? There's the thing that looks like Ben Affleck's head has actually been stuck onto the head of some guys in Iraq.
The Ben Affleck head.
But there's also another moment when he's with somebody famous. But that happens quite a lot.
Okay, look out for that. Okay. Anyway, and second point from Mark. About 20 minutes into the movie, Ben Affleck walks into a room only to be confronted with the guy from the Orange adverts.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Your friend.
My friend.
Cue giggles from the audience, who all presumably, like myself, expected him to tell Ben to do a press statement via video messaging. Given that this is in part a British production, could no one have anticipated this? I mean, the trouble is with that guy, whenever he's in anything, because he was in John Adams, which was this great HBO series, I think, it's that bloke from the Orange ad.
But honestly, wouldn't it have been great if in the middle of State of Play he had suddenly said, just text the guy, it'll all be over, it'll be fine.
John in Bradford. Bert and Ernie went to see State of Play on Wednesday, enjoyed it, but couldn't see the point. If the Americans wanted to remake the 5-part TV series, why didn't one of the networks buy the rights, update it, and show it on television? If they didn't want to remake it, they could just have shown the original BBC series. I'm not even sure why you'd pay the £8 to go to the cinema. You can buy the DVDs for £4 on the internet. Only went because it was a preview, and I have an unlimited thing. See as many films as you want.
But I thought
but it was enjoyable.
I know. So I thought it was a good, solid, enjoyable popcorn thriller. It's not more than that, but that in itself is not to be sniffed at. You liked it, didn't you? I mean, you enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it because the performances are very good. It's only slightly spoilt by the fact that as soon as it started, I remembered how the TV series concluded, and where I should be looking and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, if you remember the TV series, it does undermine it just a little bit. An email from Mark Morgan. How do you spell Mark's new favourite word? He's used it an awful lot in the last 10 minutes, so it must be important.
Oh, dear.
Schlubby. I must know, because I write reports for various reasons, and I think I could use it quite a lot.
S-C-H-L-U-B-B-Y. There's been a long-running disagreement between me and Sight and Sound as to whether it's S-H-L-U-B-B-Y or S-C-H. I think it's Germanic, so therefore schlubby. Or, you know...
Yiddish.
No. Is it Yiddish? No. Schlub. Schlepp. Yeah, maybe. In that case, it's definitely C-H.
Well, I hope that helps, Mark, even if it's a little vague. Becky says, I went to see one of the 50 cinema synchronised preview showings of State of Play this week, which was followed by a live Q&A session with Kevin MacDonald from Notting Hill Gate. Actually, a number of people say it was a really, you know, ridiculous questions like, where did you get the music kind of thing. Anyway, I thought the movie itself was okay, and while Russell Crowe was brilliant and carried the whole thing, I felt there were a few gaps and inconsistencies that worried me. Half an hour later, after the interview with a hugely affable and attractive director, I felt those gaps had been filled, and I can't wait to see the film again. All I can say is, thank the God of film that Brad Pitt dropped out at the last minute. And one of the things Kevin MacDonald said was he can't really quite imagine how Brad Pitt would have been that character.
Well, he wouldn't have been, would he? It would have been a completely different thing, and it really wouldn't have worked at all. So I think it is one of those things in which the changes have been for the better, and it does come together perfectly well. My only reservation is that it shouldn't be taken too seriously. It is, in the end, a piece of popcorn drama, and a good, efficient piece of popcorn drama of the sort that your dad would really like, apparently.
That State of Play. What else is new?
Observe and report. And it's official. I was right about the whole Seth Rogen, you know, new laddism, Revenge of the Nerds being the great... Yeah, said it was rubbish, always going to be rubbish. And now, here is proof positive that I was right and everyone else was wrong. Observe and report is the end point of all this stuff. And if it isn't, then there is something seriously wrong with the world. Now, let me just read you a couple of quotes from the press.
Well, probably is something seriously wrong with the world. Therefore, it won't stop, clearly.
OK, thanks for the optimism on that
front. Just thought I'd mention that.
In the press notes, this is directed by Jodie Hill, who made The Foot Fist Way, which is kind of all right. The producer says, Jodie wanted to defy genres. He really wanted to push the envelope with Observe and Report to do something that didn't fit into any one box. And Jodie himself says, I want to make films that are dangerous. Dangerous and controversial, even if they offend some people. So presumably what they didn't want to do was to make Paul Blart Mall Cop for teenagers. So bear in mind, Observe and Report is not Paul Blart Mall Cop, OK? So Seth Rogen plays a character who's a mall cop, like Paul Blart. And he's useless and pudgy, like Paul Blart. He has a condition which requires medication, like Paul Blart. He's got a crush on a girl at the mall, like Paul Blart. He lives with his mother, like Paul Blart. He dreams of firing a gun, like Paul Blart. But like Paul Blart, he can't actually have a gun. There's a crime happening in the mall, like in Paul Blart Mall Cop. Solving it will be his redemption, like in Paul Blart Mall Cop. And though everyone will laugh at him on the way, like Paul Blart Mall Cop, he will end up triumphing, like Paul Blart Mall Cop. Now, the gag at the centre of this, the humorous thing that has happened, is that there's a flasher running around the mall. Now, I presumably missed a meeting, because I thought that flashing ceased to be thought of as funny before the punk rock wars, and, you know, certainly in living memory, has it been funny?
Benny Hill, Dick Emery did it.
Yeah, 70s, that's before the punk rock wars. And then after that, you weren't allowed to do it anymore because it wasn't funny, OK?
You weren't allowed to?
Well, because no one laughed. Everyone went, no, that's not funny. Do you want me to... Should I prove a point?
No, don't.
Do you want to... No. Do you want to hear...
I thought you were going to flash. Oh, if you're going to play a clip, that's fine.
Okay.
For one terrifying moment, bearing in mind we're live-streamed, the nation held its breath.
I don't think it did. Here's a clip.
So, Ronnie, what is it you stopped by for?
Well, I'm sure you heard about this, but we had a pervert sexually assault several women in the mall parking lot.
Oh, really? A pervert?
Yeah. So, you know, I just thought I'd tell you, you know, just be careful watching your comings and your goings. But...
Do you think we're going to be safe?
Yeah, Bruce, I think you'll be just fine. Bruce wants to know if he'll be safe. I should warn the pervert that Bruce is out there. Look at me, I'm Bruce. Look, is the pervert going to get me?
You're not laughing.
No.
Okay.
It's got Seth Rogen in it.
No.
I tend not to laugh when Seth Rogen's involved.
So now this, remember, is the film by the guy who wanted to really push the envelope and be dangerous and controversial, even if he offends some people, and to do something that didn't fit into any one box and therefore hasn't remade Paul Blart Mall Cop. The other jokes that then sort of, you know, carry on from that is a hilarious sequence in which he takes out the girl at the makeup counter and manages to get her completely paralyzed on his medication, after which follows a scene which, if it came up in a court of law, would be seen as a really unpleasantly grey area, but is played for laughs and has one line in it that kind of implies that it's not as sinister as actually it. And in fact, is in the trailer, which kind of makes it even worse. And you're sitting there going, okay, so the guy says controversial, dark, you know, don't, even offending people. Is the problem with this that it's offending the fact that I'm a, you know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s and went through it and therefore don't consider this stuff to be funny? Or is it that it's just simply not funny? And I'm thinking, answer both of the above. He goes on to say, I think this may be the only comedy ever made that was inspired by Taxi Driver. No, that was King of Comedy, right? Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro made a comedy that was inspired by Taxi Driver, and it was called King of Comedy, and it was dark and edgy, and everything that De Niro did in it. In fact, I think Pupkin is De Niro's finest performance. I think that's the best thing he ever did. And it's that idea of you take the real darkness of the Taxi Driver, the, you know, God's Lonely Man at the heart of that, and you just twist it very slightly, and everyone knows there's a very, very thin line between comedy and tragedy. So, you pea brain, if you're listening, which I'm sure you're not, it's not the first comedy ever to be inspired by Taxi Driver. The guys who made Taxi Driver made a comedy inspired by Taxi Driver, and you know what? It would help if you went back and watched that before trying to remake Paul Blart Mall Cop. I mean, I mention it only in passing, but it's probably one of the finest movies of the decades, and not managing to see it is a crime of unforgivable proportions. Almost as unforgivable as making a film as uncomfortably unfunny as Observe and Report. Now, I did say that there were 2.5 laughs in it. One of the laughs, the half laugh, came...
There's no such thing as a half laugh.
No, there is. There is. And here it is.
It's either a laugh or it's
no,
a giggle.
There's a half a laugh. No, it's a sort... We did this before, but there's a proper laugh, right? The half laugh came at this moment when I suddenly realised that the song playing on the soundtrack was It's Late by Queen, which I think is from the News of the World album, which is one album after I stopped buying all Queen records on the basis that after Day at the Races and no, I'm not going there anymore. I've suffered, you know, I was there, Sheer Heart Attack and Queen 2 and everything fine. Then after Day at the Races, no. But I suddenly thought, blimey, this is a really good song. I'm going to have to go out and get News of the World. News of the World with the one with the robot, you know, with their hair falling out. Do you remember that?
Right.
And I did a half laugh at the point that I realised that 25 years later, 30 years down the line, having boycotted Queen from the point of Day at the Races, that I was going to have to go into a record shop and go, have you got a copy of News of the World? It's from my dad. He likes the French Connection. Is that okay? Thanks very much. So that was the half laugh. The other two laughs were, you know, walking into walls, banging noses, that sort of stuff. Nothing, you know, nothing of any consequence. But both of those laughs felt guilty and putrid because it's in the context of this, you know, retrograde nonsense that isn't funny and does appear to have been made by somebody who says they want to be dark and controversial, even if it offends some people. But, you know, just offending people on its own isn't good enough. There's lots of people who are offensive. That in itself is not good enough. If you want to make a movie that genuinely thinks outside the box, don't remake Paul Blart. If you want to make a movie that thinks outside the box, don't make a movie that has every gender stereotype imaginable and doesn't do anything interesting. Don't make a movie in which the schlubby guy meets an obviously glamorous girl who's dressing down for the purposes of revealing herself at the end of the movie to be the girl that he's obviously should end up with, the real sweetheart of the movie. Don't do that. Don't do that. If you want to make something, make him fall in love with somebody. I'm actually ripping my headphones up. I mean,
headphones moved, glasses moved to a Captain Mannering angle.
There's a scene in it in which, and Ray Liotta's in it. I mean, Ray Liotta's career, ever since he was in that Guy Ritchie movie, I mean, you've hardly been able to hear him for the sound of him going around the U-bend. There's a moment when Paul Blart goes for it, not Paul Blart, whatever he's called, Seth Rogen, goes for a cop interview and he can't get the job. And some guys are listening next door because they think it's going to be funny. And then one of them opens the door and says, no, I thought this was going to be funny, but actually it's just really sad. And I thought, and there, my work is done.
Megan and Dodge Rogers.
Did I make it clear that it wasn't funny?
Megan and Dodge Rogers watching live from Maine in USA. Dear Werner and Klaus, my husband and I often catch the podcast, but today we're watching the webcast live in Rockland, Maine.
Just saw my glasses coming off.
Setting of the Sissy Spacek film In the Bedroom, you might like to know. We recently watched Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man and would like to correct Mark. According to Mr. Herzog, the common denominator of the universe is chaos, hostility and murder, and not chaos, murder and death.
Oh, sorry. Chaos, murder and death. What I said was chaos, disharmony and murder. It's chaos, hostility and murder.
We also want to say yes, about love, actually. In the long, cold winter, we watched it almost every day. We can't wait for the boat that rocked to come stateside.
Because love actually is all around.
It's, that was...
chaos, disharmony. And what is it, chaos?
It's chaos, hostility.
That's what he says. Chaos, hostility, and murder. And in a minute, we're going to do Encounter at the End of the World. I don't want to see fluffy penguins.
Is it Outlander coming next?
Well, I'm going to do it, because you've now brought it up. I'm going to do Encounter at the End of the World first.
I will do that. Next week on the programme, Stephen Fry and David Morrissey on the same Friday show. How about that for Wittertainment next week? That's pretty good. Not me. Why not you?
No, well, you didn't say and me. So I just thought maybe you meant that they were coming on, so you didn't need me anymore.
Oh, dear me. No, of course you're going to be here. You've only just come back. You can't go away again. So Mark's going to be here next week.
We're invited, that's all.
And Stephen Fry and Dave. Hello to Stephen Fry.
Hello to Stephen Fry.
Hello to Jason Isaacs, who missed you very much.
He did, and I was going to go and see Good this morning, because it came out when I was away. This is really annoying, because the Jason Isaacs film comes out the weeks that I'm off. I don't go and see it. I wanted to go and see it over the weekend down in Southampton. It wasn't playing in Southampton. It obviously opened in London and then spread slowly, and I was going to go and see it this morning, but then I had to cancel because you and me had an appointment in the BBC...
in the Blue Peter Gardens. Filming something about our next little outside broadcast.
Incredibly strange. So I still haven't seen it, and I still want to. And I know this gives the impression to Jason, who'll be listening, that I have seen it, and I didn't like it, and therefore I'm not saying. I swear I haven't seen it. I want to go and see it. Now, you saw it, and you enjoyed it, and he was on the show.
I did enjoy it, as I said to him at the time, though, and said last week, I still don't quite...
By the Vigo.
The central premise.
Yeah, you said that, yeah.
Still very good. And hello to Fairport Convention, Mitch, Ben, and Focus. And Sophie, BA Honours Geography, favourite film of all time, La Belle et la Bête.
Oh, okay.
Fantastic early special effects on French postmodern surrealism in northwest London.
What was that in relation to?
That was just the preamble.
Oh, I see.
That's like the pre-title sequence, that was.
I see, okay.
Could you just please wish all the very best of luck to my boyfriend, Tom, MSc Neuroscience, who's running the London Marathon. He's a huge fan of the Review podcast. It's been helping him get through his marathon training. And that's happening on Sunday. So if you're Tom and you're going out with Sophie, hope it goes very well. And everyone else who's doing the London Marathon.
If you're Tom and you're not going out with Sophie, she thinks you are.
Yes.
You better sort that out.
Or the Duke of Edinburgh scheme thing, which is happening this weekend as well. So what else is new?
Well, let's very quickly do Encounter at the End of the World, which is the new Werner Herzog film. I mean, I cannot get enough of Werner Herzog. He's in a very interesting point in his life because he's done an awful lot of documentary work alongside the feature films, because the features he's best known for are things like, you know, Fitzcarraldo, Aguirre, Wrath of God, you know, all of which are about characters in extremis. And then he's done these documentaries, these very strange documentaries like Little Dieter Needs to Fly, which ended up being his first real Hollywood movie. He made a sort of, you know, a Hollywood movie version of it, Rescue Dawn. And then he's made things like, there was a very strange movie called The Wild Blue Yonder, in which he took a bunch of science film but gave it a science fiction narration about Brad Dourif being an alien who came down to Earth, but aliens are all rubbish, and they tried to start up a shopping mall and it didn't work out very well. And he gets footage of underwater divers underneath the ice caps and says that, in fact, what they are is spacemen arriving at the frozen atmosphere of Earth and then coming into Earth's freezing atmosphere. And it's, and, you know, all narrated by Werner Herzog. And it's somewhere between fiction and reality, but not. Actually, that was narrated by Brad Dourif. So now we get, in a way, the flip side of Wild Blue Yonder, which is the proper documentary in which essentially Werner Herzog goes with one camera. It's him and a cameraman. I mean, this is real stripped-down filmmaking, but it looks... I mean, I... saw it at the National Film Theatre on their big BFI South Bank, I think it's now referred to, on their big screen. It looked terrific. So he goes to this remote place, Antarctica, to go and speak to people who are out there to discover what it is about them and their lives that have taken them out to the end of the world. And he says very specifically he didn't want to make a movie about fluffy penguins, although at one point he does go out and sees some fluffy penguins, and he goes out with a penguin expert who he obviously upsets by asking whether penguins ever get psychotic and crazy. And then, of course, it being a Herzog documentary, there's this pack of, you know, all this, the stuff that everyone knows about penguins, but, you know, they're all incredibly brilliant, they do this amazing stuff and it's all fabulously choreographed, and they all know exactly where they're going, and there's sort of a demonstration of how society can just function absolutely brilliantly.
And they get married as
they
well,
get married, yeah. Yes, and then half of them are gay, which is brilliant, and they have, you know, civil ceremonies, and that's terrific as well, and that's no really that's a I'm thinking ideal society, good for it. Herzog turns up there with his camera. What does he find? He finds the lone gunman in the penguins, right? His camera picks out the one penguin who has lost the plot.
And does it then shoot Werner Herzog?
No.
Then you can film a documentary.
Exactly. Who is heading off tangentially to the rest of the pack, obviously heading straight for oblivion. Of course, Herzog finds him. I mean, Herzog said once, and it's absolutely true, that he was like a magnet for crazy people. And it's true. He's also a magnet for crazy penguins, on the evidence of this. So it's one of those documentaries which essentially, if what you like is philosophy, but with extraordinary images, I mean, underwater cathedrals of ice and, you know, things that you really haven't seen before, extraordinary oral sounds and interviews with people who really are living on the very edge of the world, the very edge of existence, all speaking to Werner Herzog, everything in this Bavarian monotone. See, what Herzog's main thesis is that there is no... We live in a godless universe, okay? Chaos, hostility and murder are the underlying traits. And I interviewed him on stage at the NFT, and I said to him the thing that I've been wanting to say to him for ages and ages and ages, which was, if it's true that we live in a godless universe with nothing bringing everything... How is it that something as beautiful as your films can exist? And there was a lovely moment. This was a few months ago, because it turns out somebody said that Stuart Lee, the comedian, was talking about Richard Hawking on television the other day and said something eerily similar to this. So I just want to say...
Richard Hawking, is that the same? Is it Richard Dawkins or Stephen Hawking?
Alistair Bing Bong.
Alistair Darling.
Alistair Ding Dong, yeah, same. But you know what I'm like with names? Is it in a movie? I don't know. You know, the incredibly intelligent one, History of Time.
Stephen Hawking,
what did I say?
Richard Hawking.
Stephen Hawking. Well, but I don't know, I didn't see it. I'm just doing...
Am I confused, okay, a stupid
fine.
Person?
Forget that. I'm just trying to prove that I said this before. Anyway, so I'm sitting there with Werner Herzog on stage.
I've forgotten what we're talking about.
And I said, I can't believe, if the world is truly godless and if there is no order in the universe, then how come it can produce something as beautiful as your films? And Werner Herzog took a deep breath and he leant forward into the microphone. He said, I stem the tide. And I thought, that's it. You and me, Werner, are joined at the hip forever.
Julian in Leamington, dear Mulder and Scully, looking forward to the Outlander review, especially since, despite somehow managing to be a little dull, the film has the best premise in the world. Dragons versus Vikings versus Jesus with alien technology.
Yeah, well, let's do it very quickly because we're going to run out of time and I do want to get shifty. I mean, basically, the deal with Outlander is... Just read that synopsis out again.
Dragons versus Vikings versus Jesus with alien technology.
Okay, so what he means is that it's a movie that stars Jim Caviezel, comes down from outer space, lands Viking world, okay? Other space beasties around coming down with. Meanwhile, big tribe of... One of the things I didn't like Outlander at all, I was bored rigid by it. One of the reasons I was bored rigid by it is that any movie with hairy goth-like people going, ha-ha-ha, a lot, I just think, oh, I'm not interested. I have a fundamental problem with bad haircuts in films. Don't. And I was troubled by that. But so it is Vikings meet outer space aliens, and the lead Viking is played by Jim Caviezel, and the glamorous woman from the Viking tribe, who is the daughter of John Hurt, is played by the woman who plays Lady Penelope in the Thunderbirds movie. And so therefore there's been much made about the fact that it's a film in which, you know, the deity incarnate ends up going off into the sunset with Lady Penelope. And believe me, in a way, that makes the film sound much more interesting than it is. What it is it's a movie with an endless amount of hairy Visigoths. Do we call
them? I'll
do. Visigoths.
That's probably enough. If you want to talk about Shifty,
I do.
And you're going to say, oh, it's the movie of the week. At least give it 3 minutes.
I'm going to say very quickly about Shifty. It's the latest film from this London microwave thing, which is, I quote, a unique micro-budget feature film scheme set up in partnership with the BBC Films. I have to say that because it's obviously a conflict of interest. A groundbreaking initiative which challenged London-based filmmakers to shoot a full-length feature for £100,000, which is, you know, a very, very small amount of money. They did make a previous film, which was Mum and Dad, which I didn't like very much. It was a horror movie, although it was interesting because it was released simultaneously in cinemas and on download. And I was thinking about this when I was listening to the piracy discussion you had, that actually, of course, the solution to piracy is simply that the industry, you know, wakes up and starts dealing with downloadable and in different accessible ways of moving and gives the public what it is they want. I am sick and tired of hearing the industry complain about how much damage piracy does. You know what? Guys, keep up. Do what the music industry was doing. Sort it out. If people want to go and see movies in the cinema, great. If they want to see them at home, great. You know, if the people who want to watch the movies at home can watch them at home so they're not annoying me in the cinema, I'll happily stump up the money to sit in a half-empty cinema because I don't want those people who, you know, think they can talk all the way through movies because they've been used to watching things on catch. Here ends the lesson.
When you're on holiday, do you listen to the programme all the time?
Some of the time.
Yes, okay.
Some of the time. My kids got really annoyed because I was on the beach listening to you and Jason Isaacs.
I think I'm with the kids now.
Yeah, anyway, so it stars Danny Mays, who is really good, and Reese Ahmed. Danny Mays, they're two kids, they've been sort of friends together. Then Danny Mays has gone off to Manchester. Something bad has happened between them. Danny Mays is now making a new life in Manchester. Danny Mays was so great in Vera Drake. Comes back down, and they meet each other, and there's some unspoken thing which has happened in their past. The Riz Ahmed character has become a drug dealer and is involved in criminality, and his life is not doing what it ought to be doing. And Danny Mays is effectively saying, come away, mate. Come away with me to Manchester. And it's a character drama. Now, it looks on the outside like it might be one of those kind of Leary Geezer drug dealer movies. I can't stand Leary Geezer drug dealer movies. I really can't. But this was a character-based thing which had two very, very good performances, actually more than two very good performances at the centre of it. All of Jay Simpson, I thought, was also terrific. And made for a very, very low budget and about people, about characters that you could genuinely believe in. And although it's not massively cinematic, considering what they've done with such little resources and considering just how real it all felt, I thought it was an admirable piece of work, and particularly admirable when you see just how much they've made of so little.
Movie of the week?
I still think State of Play, because I think it's a solid drama.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.